KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 28th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 2nd through March 3rd. The Cascade Festival of African Films shows us Africa through the eyes of Africans, rather than a vision of Africa packaged for Western viewers. The films represent different countries and cultures and a range of lifestyles from pre-colonial to modern times, including both rural and urban settings. Films include 76 and The Footprints of Pan-Africanism and more at the Hollywood Theater, and The African Who Wanted to Fly, Foreign Bodies, Wulu, and many more at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104 at the PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 20th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 2nd through March 3rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hosting, barring something happening, this is the last week that you'll hear from me, so we're going out with a bang. And today I have a great interview guest that we'll get to. First, I want to mention that KBOO has their Kickstarter campaign going on, so please, if you can, support the Kickstarter. It's kboo.fm/Kickstarter, I believe. And if you want to call in today, which you probably should call in today, it's going to be a great show. It's 503-231-8187. Again, that's 503-231-8187. So I was going to talk about the news a little bit. Yesterday I was watching the town hall with the kids that were survivors of the shooting that happened, and it was really good. I think that, you know, I don't know if anybody has specific answers on how we stop what's going on with the school shootings, but I do think that most people would agree that doing nothing really isn't enough. And I also think most people would agree that maybe the NRA doesn't have everybody's best interest in mind. And so these kids were really taking it to Marco Rubio and the NRA in person. And I think that, you know, every year we see multiples of these happen and then nothing happens after that. And if it is ever going to be different, and, you know, I'm not saying that it's people taking guns or even what I think that the measure should be, because I don't have the answers. But if we're going to do something, I think that it starts with sort of these kids being so active and vocal. And I've been really impressed with, after they survived that shooting, still going out and doing that. We also have, you know, there's a little bit of news with the Russia investigation heating up. There were 13 indictments from Russians that were interfering with our election. So I'm not, you know, super collusion person that thinks, I definitely don't think that Donald Trump is probably going to be impeached or anything like that. But I do think that it's troubling that we had people interfering with our elections, but it doesn't take Russians to interfere with your elections. We have fascist people that are posting things that we know are fake all the time and sort of getting people riled up. And some of that is circulated apparently from Russian bots. I had a message from Twitter that I was engaging with Russians. And so they didn't tell me who were the Russians. So now I just have to look over my shoulder and see. But so there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in the news. But today we have a special guest. I'm here with Armenio, and he is a local anti-fascist, which I think we should all be anti-fascist. But could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Hi, I'm Armenio. I'm a Portland anti-fascist, and I've been doing this activity probably for the better part of 10 years now, since before Occupy Portland, and now we're here.
So what is the difference between anti-fascist and Antifa?
So that's actually a really easy question to answer. Antifa is the media side and the spectacle side of what we consider anti-fascist methodology. And to be an anti-fascist is simply to make an ideological disagreement with fascism. To be an Antifa is to get roped into the media blitz and the media stories and let them control the narrative about our politics.
Is there self-identified Antifa, or is it kind of like whoever is the bad guys or the media just picks and chooses who's Antifa?
I mean, you know, there's a mix of self-identified kids on the internet
who, yeah,
you know, get on Facebook because they don't have anywhere else to go.
Uh-huh.
But as far as real-life declarations, Antifa is never something someone uses to describe themselves. It's always prescriptive from someone else.
So there's not like a card-carrying membership?
Oh, no, I wish there was. That'd be kind of cool.
There's no company barbecues?
No, nothing like that.
You get your George Soros checks or anything like that?
See, I wish, and that's always been my problem with anti-fascism, is we don't have money.
No.
And so, you know, people are always like, oh, you're this corporate thing, get all this money everywhere, and it's like, no.
And you're like, no, but that would be helpful.
Would
do you
be
have
so
some?
Helpful. Someone paid me for the hours of research I have to do.
So what is anti-fascist, like, organizing, or what does that mean in action?
So it all really depends on who you talk to. It can mean a plethora of different things, but more often than not, people kind of agree on the opinion that it is 99% boredom of detective work and 1% of fun, flashy fight scenes.
Uh-huh.
So
that's kind of like war.
Yeah, no, it really is like war. You have to know your enemy, and that what people really mistake anti-fascism for as, you know, these street fighting and stuff, mm-hmm. which there is a fair amount of it, especially in Europe, where you have to, where it's a life or death situation oftentimes, like Greece, for example. But here in America, you know, you have to know who the Nazis are, and part of that is researching. And so, you know, when people think anti-fascist, they think, you know, oh, here's the big scary guys in the all black, when actually it's me in my underwear at 3 a.m. going through the white pages, court records, voting records, and trying to find addresses and different other stuff.
But is it also sometimes you in the scary costume?
No, I never do that.
But that is a part of anti-fascism.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it's a necessary part?
Oh, 100%.
Why is that necessary?
So fascism, the way it finds its power is within its voice. And the more projection it has, the more power it can attain. The more people it reaches, the more people it can have. And so preventing it from reaching people prevents it from gaining more power. It's as simple as that.
And are the fascists, the bad guys, they're also not necessarily self-identified fascists, right?
Right, right. Like, you know, for instance, the Proud Boys.
Yeah.
They never declare themselves as fascists.
Uh-huh.
They declare themselves as Western chauvinists. But when you look at interviews with Gavin McManus and his economic positions, when you listen to what they believe, harsh traditionalism, celebration of colonialism and imperialism, what they embody is, you know, more traditional Mussolini-style fascism, uh-huh. which is capitalism and decay.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's kind of the same thing. You know, no one on the left sometimes says they're an anti-fascist, and people on the right don't say they're fascist, but when you actually look at the nitty-gritty politics and the ideology involved, then that's really where it shows.
And that makes it a little difficult when you have, you know, like if somebody's saying, hey, we're here to stop you because you're fascist, and then they just say, no, we're not fascist, right? Especially when you have a lazy media who then films that confrontation and it looks like the anti-fascists are maybe overreacting or calling people out because the media doesn't also give you a list of policies of both sides, right? Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And the strength of the far right in constantly moving around and re-aestheticizing their politics is that they can say whatever they want. Mm-hmm. You know, this like new wave of conservatism, we saw this in the 60s and 80s already.
Oh.
This is just a new wave of it. The whole Make America Great Again slogan, that's from the Reagan campaign.
Mm.
It's all from this guy, Roger Stone. There's a good documentary on Netflix about him.
Get me Roger Stone.
Yeah, right. that guy. But so the right has this power where can they just say, oh, we're not fascist, we're traditionalist, or neo-Strasserites. I mean, there's so many different words that they can use, and that makes things really difficult, especially when you're trying to confront them, and little old grandma liberal comes up, and it's like, oh, you gotta stop with the violence.
Yeah.
It's really hard to explain, like, you know, no, we can't, because if we're not violent, they will be.
But then doesn't it put a lot of responsibility on the anti-fascists, because now you not only, like, you are basically tasked now and somewhat self-tasked with declaring who's a fascist and who's not.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of not only ethical responsibility personally, but the stress involved with anti-fascist work is, you know, if you make a wrong call and say someone's a fascist when they're not, that's on you if they get beat up.
Yeah.
That's completely your fault.
Yeah.
And so practicing due diligence, however, anti-fascists 99% of the time are right on who they call fascist.
Yeah.
Because it's that research that we depend on that we do, you know, verifying sources, making sure it's the correct address, you know, comparing faces.
But how do we know we're hearing from actual anti-fascists that are putting in the work? Because not only do we have the incredibly fake Antifa pages, but we also have people that might just call themselves Antifa and then, you know, like, there's no, because there's no membership or anything like that, I could make a page and I could have the best of intentions and then, you know, and be calling people out and be wrong because I'm not doing the research.
Right. So the most credible one, what I would suggest, the most credible ones are ones that post 3-page or more articles on who they're talking about.
Okay.
If it's less than 3 pages, then you're
not just not just like a paragraph that's like, we really don't like this guy, we saw him here.
Exactly. That stuff, that's like, no. But, you know, like Rose City Antifa, they're absolutely amazing for the work they do. Eugene Antifa, Pacific Northwest Anti-Fascist Workers Collective. Those are the three main in the Pacific Northwest
good. If I understand correctly, Rose City Antifa has been around since way before people were saying Antifa, really.
Yep. Rose City Antifa was started in 2007 in response to David Irving coming to Portland. Famous Holocaust denier.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, terrible person, but that all started in 2007. And what really grew Rose City Antifa was the taking down of Volksfront, which was a Nazi prison support gang.
So it is, Trump a fascist?
That's always a really hard question, because a simple, when it comes to people who are in politics and actually deciding these policies, they don't make their stances completely clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really has to, that definition, if we're ever going to call Trump a fascist, has to come from actually the policies he's implementing and the economic policies he's implementing, which could be argued to be fascist, actually.
Yeah.
All because the economic system of fascism, as Mussolini defined it, was corporatism, which is not, as people commonly understand it, corporations, but a meddling from the state as the main middleman negotiating between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie.
Mm-hmm.
And it retains all power to the bourgeoisie, obviously, because the state is always a reflection of the class of power. And so that's kind of what's happening right now, especially with the new tax plan and the quote-unquote reinvigoration of the production economy, at least that sector of the economy. So it's, I mean, we'll have to wait and see a couple more years, I think, before we can call him a fascist, but it's not far off.
Yeah, closer than we've seen in a while.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think that a lot of people that, I mean, mostly how America works is we talk about people on the ends of whatever political spectrum, but most people lie somewhere within the middle. Not that those most people are probably right, but in those most people kind of look, you know, it's the horseshoe theory that both sides, I remember the Oregonian said something about the Antifa being the real fascist or something like that. And it's like anybody that understands like political ideology, you can disagree with their political stances or something, but they're not fascist. So, but are most Trump supporters fascist?
No, I would say most Trump supporters are just wrong.
Yeah. Wow. And so, but they're also probably more susceptible to the fascist rhetoric from the people who really are fascists.
Right? Oh, yeah. I mean, what we're seeing now is what we saw in everywhere that fascism took a rising is a disenfranchised proletariat with no real organizing or union power being goaded by the far right into believing these awful things because they think it'll help them because everyone likes getting help. And then they get screwed over in the end. Like, for instance, going back to Reagan, a lot of people don't know this, but Reagan destroyed the Midwest farming industry and actually created how we know as it now of these large corporations owning all this land. He, with his new tax plan, essentially, farmers had to take out another mortgage to simplify it, not get in a 30-hour debate. And so that ended up costing, 40 to 60% of all farmers lost their land.
Wow.
So it's
standing up for the little guy.
Yep. Yeah. So just like Reagan, Trump is going to be doing the same thing, I assume, that industries are going to fall.
So we go from Trump is maybe a fascist, but most Trump supporters probably aren't fascists. What about the people we see at the alt-right rallies? Because if you show up at these rallies, you basically have signed up for possible violence, right?
Oh, yeah.
In the name, you know, so... if you show up, especially on the right, are those mostly fascists then?
Yes, actually, those, because they're opportunists. They're taking an opportunity because they're, you know, fascism now is a political point that can be debated. America has decided that Nazism, fascism, third positionism, it's allowed to be debated now.
Yeah.
And so with that, they see an opening. A social rupture, so to speak, as anarchists call it, where they can intervene with their politics and recruit.
Yeah.
And that's what we see at literally every Joey Gibson rally.
And speaking of Joey Gibson, so there was, I think, two times at the Joey Gibson rallies where I was like, you know, I'm going to go in and just hear this guy. Mm-hmm. Not because I was like, I want to give him a chance, but it was like, I want to know my enemy, right? And I was like, this guy could speak at a Bernie Sanders rally. Like, this guy, like, the things that he says sound good.
Let's frame it this way. Joey Gibson has a master's degree in psychology.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
But no job.
So let's think about it like that. He has a master's degree in psychology, and he preaches the absolute bottom of the barrel, and doesn't really have a coherent and consistent political message. It is merely just conjecture and flowery prose to whatever ill people are facing right now.
Okay. I think we have some callers on the line. Let's take a caller. Who do we got? Sean.
Hey, good morning, guys. Good morning. About 3 years ago, economist Richard Wolff gave a lecture, and it's kind of haunted me ever since. He made the argument that Americans are no longer needed as workers, that is, as producers, but we're also not even needed as consumers anymore, as new consumer markets have opened up around the world. So the thing that haunts me is that the workers and the poor no longer have any leverage. We have no negotiating power. And the Democratic Party has consciously chosen to cast its lot as far as fundraising, largely with Wall Street, Big Pharma, and Silicon Valley. Thomas Frank's book, Listen Liberal, I thought did a great job of kind of articulating that. So the Democratic Party has consciously chosen to abandon poor and working class people, and we see that with Bill Clinton's deregulation of Wall Street and the free trade agreements and so forth. And the Republican Party They're openly, as far as I'm concerned, the so-called public-private partnership infrastructure plan, that is about as purely fascist as you could possibly get. I mean, that's openly promoting the idea of government, you know, giving profits to these companies just to do basic public works. So I was wondering if you guys could address, like, just the, you know, with the basic, with the destruction of the trade union movement and, you know, massive economic inequality, it's like our country is going through a national nervous breakdown because poor and working class people no longer have any outlet to exercise any leverage whatsoever. So if you guys could address that, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, no, thank you for that call. You actually bring up a very good point that I highly agree with, that the working class and really just the disenfranchised poor in general, whether it's the lumpen proletariat or the proletariat, does not have any organizing power as a mass unified body. There is no working class movement anymore on the left side of things, and the Republicans have completely taken advantage of that. However, bringing up the Democrats, and I think this is the main problem with the left as we see it, we frame ourselves within that spectrum of the Democratic left-right moderate centrist debate, and we let that frame our politics, and that puts us on the same side as the Democrats according to the right wing. What we need to do is remove ourselves from that left-right dogmatic spectrum that America has and really establish ourselves as communist, as socialist, and really make that point clear. You know, we want a free working class that does not have to have their surplus value extracted from them, as simple as that. But we're not going to do that as long as we're attached to the Democratic Party. They're complete morons, and we need to just cut the slate clean.
And so I think that a lot of people agree with that, and a lot of people also don't, because what they would say is, well, they already have like an established power. They're the best we got. It's the lesser of two evils argument. So how would you dismantle the lesser of two evils argument?
If they're the best we got, and then that means we should get out of our homes and actually meet each other.
Huh. Yeah. And so let's go back to Joey Gibson. We kind of touched on it a little bit. Is Joey Gibson a fascist?
No. Joey Gibson is not a fascist. And I say that because he is not anything. He doesn't have politics.
So, but he likes Donald Trump, but is it basically just based on rhetoric, or he's an opportunist?
He's an opportunist. He's making money. I mean, notice how he doesn't have a job.
Yeah.
Tiny works at a very low income job, let's put it that way. A lot of them do not have the means to support the movement that they're supporting.
Yeah.
What's happening is they're having outside investment firms and outside money coming in.
So they're the paid protesters.
Yeah, they're the paid protesters. they're the ones making money off of all this controversy. Like, you know, how many views did Robert Zerfing, for example, get on his crappy YouTube channel before Joey Gibson? He got like less than 100. I mean, yeah, he acts like no one knew about him. I've known about him for a while now, but now
did you
his
see the
views,
music video?
Huh?
Did you see the music video?
I did, and that was the most depressing thing I've ever seen. That, you know, like, I like to say, like, oh, no, white people can listen to hip-hop, and then they go release that, and that completely contradicts my statement that white people have good taste in music, so, like, thanks, I guess. But, no, you know, like, all these people, they got famous from these fist fights on the waterfront and this useless conjecture of, oh, we're gonna take back the West Coast. They haven't taken back anything, and their rallies have less than 100 people consistently.
But they're consistent, like, and that they keep happening. And I thought, you know, when they started really dwindling, because we saw, you know, like June 4th or the ones in like Oswego or Salem, and there were more and more people, when they started dwindling, I was like, okay, they're eventually going to dwindle to just this core group, and then it's going to be nothing. But it's like, I just don't get, like, I feel like poor Republicans and people on the right have been doing this since probably before the Civil War, but the Civil War is like where other people fight their battles and like are willing to die for them, and then they keep fighting. Like, You know, like, people are dying throughout the Civil War that didn't own slaves, right? And mm-hmm. but they're dying for that. But these people now are, like, the ones that are going and fighting, like, that are... Joey Gibson's not throwing that many punches. Like, the people that are and, like, are getting bloodied up and these kinds of things, like, aren't famous. Like, mm-hmm. what do they have to gain from this? And, like, when are they going to realize that, like, somebody else is profiting from their actual blood?
So I like to think about it like this. Say, you know, you wake up in the morning and ask yourself, what do you have to be proud of about America? You know, we tell ourselves, well, nothing really. Mm. There's, you know, maybe some rights here and there. First Amendment's kind of cool. I like the Second Amendment. I like my guns. But otherwise, we don't really have anything to be proud of. We're not number one in infrastructure. We're not number one in healthcare. We're not number one in education. We're not number one in anything. We're actually, the only number one thing we're at is prison population.
About freedom.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. Freedom. Forgot about that buzzword. But these right-wingers, they wake up and they ask themselves the same thing, and they have the same answer. Nothing. And so Trump and Joey Gibson and all these alt-right figures come around saying, oh, well, you have this to be proud of, your skin, your heritage, your country, your traditions, which America doesn't have traditions. Fireworks is not a tradition. Don't tell me it is. So it's filling this void in their hearts that can't get filled with anything else because the left has no propaganda machine. Huh. We don't have political centers that can constantly pump out this horrible propaganda where Obama's a socialist. We don't have that.
I wish we did. Maybe KBOO. So once somebody has begun being a Joey Gibson fan, whether you're showing up at the rallies or not, where you're like actually maybe not a self-avowed fascist, but you're basically there, are you savable? Can we pull you back? Or is that where only violence comes in?
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't use the word savable, but I do think that's actually an appropriate word. I would more use... you know, the word pushing in the right direction. You know, if you're a poor working class person, the right wing is not in your interest. The left wing is, because the left wing is going to make sure that you have a union and you're taken care of. The right wing's just going to say, you know,
you have race.
Yeah, good job.
When we talk about the leftist, and do you consider yourself an anarchist or?
Yes.
Okay, so let's talk about. Are communists your friends, socialists? Like, they're obviously better than fascists, but are there, like, these big disagreements also on the left between anarchism and communism? And, like, how big are those disagreements? Are they to where, like, we don't talk to each other? Like, what does that look like?
So those disagreements are actually just the same as what the alt-right's going through, actually, of constantly yelling on the same side of the barricades. Those disagreements... a lot of them are due to people not reading their books and stuff. The main disagreement between anarchist and communist is the question of the state.
But we're so not there yet.
We're not even there. It's the most pointless debate. Yeah. You know, you see like internet communists arguing like, oh, well, we need to have gulags. And it's like,
you're so far away from gulags.
Yeah, right. Your organization doesn't even have two people in it. Like, what are you talking about? Gulags? Secret police? Well, it's the same thing with anarchists, too, like saying, oh, you know, when there's no capitalism, I can't wait for automation. Like, we're not even at the point where we have control of an industry yet. Yeah. This conjecture, and that's where all these debates come from and these fights. It comes from this future projection that these ideologies have or people think they have, when in reality, all our politics are framed in the here and now. Yeah. And that's how we experience them, and that's how we critique them, and that's how we understand them. Mm. And if we're not saying that to ourselves, we get, you know, left book.
And I will concede that you're far more better read on these subjects than me. But my understanding is sort of like the Spanish Civil War. We had communists, anarchists, like everybody was like, look, we have to, and in between was like, we have to fight against fascism and we'll figure out our differences like when we don't have a fascist.
Kind
Something
of
like that.
That was so the Spanish Civil War, what really started it was the attempted coup by Franco and the response by the anarchist CNT, the biggest union, which is actually still around, and the communist PUM, who were Trotskyists at the time. And they were the main ones in Barcelona who really, you know, started the fighting, started the organizing, and were already kind of organized, honestly.
But that's a big unification right there, because they have big differences.
Oh, yeah. And then that goes into the question of what went wrong, and there's thousands of things, whether it's the anarchists completely unable to have a planned collectivized economy. They weren't ready for it, and they trusted too much peasant ownership, and that kind of made logistics impossible. It could be the communist ordered by Stalin to shoot anti-fascist. It could be the CNT anarchist saying go back to work in the name of anti-fascism and put down your guns. There's myriad of things, but no one political ideology is at fault except fascism.
But like the idea of, look, these leftist groups have big disagreements, but like they should unite on maybe on what they do agree on, and we should fight it out later. Because let's say that it goes all as planned, wouldn't there then be a war between the anarchists and the Trotskyites, like, also?
Right, and so that, I do not believe in left unity personally.
Uh-huh.
I believe in unity from the bottom, and what that means is, in the context of fascist attacks and labor disputes, I will unite with anybody. I will be on the picket line with anybody as long as you are there to hold that picket line.
Sure.
Outside of that, I have no reason to organize with Trotskyist, Maoist, or anything like that.
So you weren't canvassing for the health law?
No. I was, what do I canvass for? I was canvassing for weed. That was...
Oh.
Yeah, I like weed.
All right. Well, so one of the anarchist stereotypes and the Antifa stereotypes is true.
Oh, yeah. I actually got introduced to weed by my fiance. She was like, oh, you have a hard job or your back hurts. Smoke a little weed. And I was like, okay, why not? Changed my life.
Wow. So voting does do things.
Yeah, sure, why not?
Okay.
We'll say that.
I think we have a message now about the Kickstarter.
Yeah, sure. Good morning. Here I am. I'm Ani, and it's really, really good to be with you this morning, Gregory. This is a great conversation. I'm sitting over here, like, you know, as a anarchist going, yeah, this is great.
And this is good morning radio.
Good morning radio, right? And to me, this is the epitome of KBOO. Like, where else are you going to be hearing, you know, people discussing, is there a possibility of left unification and the pragmatic issues that would be involved with that, right?
At 8 in the morning.
Or at any time, you know, really, when you're looking at the corporate-owned media and mainstream press, this is not a debate that exists, because really that part of the spectrum doesn't exist. You have two parties, people align with one of them, and that's what exists. You know, and they define that reality. But here at KBOO, we are people's media. We are community media. And that means we have folks like you, like me, straight out of the communities, that have a passion to change the world and make it a better place. And the way that we're able to engage in this media is because KBOO has had this free training program for 50 years, teaching people how to access media, how to actually use the tools to create FM broadcasts, and now into podcasts and into the digitized media to help amplify the messages out of our communities. And that's what this Kickstarter campaign is all about. It's building a city of media makers. We've been at it for 50 years, and we want to enhance what we've been doing and spread it so that we can actually go into communities and help get the tools of making media out there. And that's why we need our listeners to spread the word about the Kickstarter campaign. If you can't contribute yourself this morning, at least spread the word. Help get the campaign out there in your social media feeds, whichever ones you might use. It's kboo.fm/Kickstarter will take you straight to that page, or if you happen to be a Kickstarter supporter, you can just search KBOO on your Kickstarter page and you'll find us easily. We've picked up some momentum this week, and that's fantastic. We're looking to raise $20,000 by March 9th. And so right now is a great time to share that word and share that message. It's super important that we reach that goal, because what we're doing is actually getting field recording kits into the hands of community members.
Well,
so
that's
they
amazing.
Can, right? You know, and we have some, but I tell you, they're in sad shape because they're in the hands of community members going out and getting good audio
all the time, right?
And so if you think about what your own personal devices, the wear and tear on them go through, think about them being used by 300 people, right? And so, you know, yesterday we had this live stream, and Jenka, our social media coordinator, brings to me one of our field recording kits, and it's like most of them are, at this point, have lost the little latches on their battery doors, so we just tape the batteries in, right?
No.
And that's the kind of, you know, because we need to get the word out. We need to get the word back into the station, right? We need to collect audio wherever it's lively. And that means we need field recording kits and we need people trained to use them. So we have to continue our training program and we want to keep that free so it's accessible to everyone, regardless of your socioeconomic status, right? We have programs here by and for everyone in the community, as long as we all come together around the principles of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. Those are the eight values that guide KBOO. So it's an important thing to be a part of, an important thing to contribute to. And, you know, like, we give amazing activists from the community the microphone and have you, like, please, for a month, get the word out. What do you want to do? How do you want to use KBOO to spread the good word about how we organize and what our lives are like and what fighting fascism is? How do we do this resistance thing and how do we do it together? So that's at the essence of what we do with our training program all day, every day. That's what we do with community radio and community media. And we're asking you to support Kickstarter. That's kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Why did you say yes to this opportunity, Gregory? You're a busy guy.
Because I thought that it was important to have these types of conversations on the airwaves, you know. I wasn't sure. I thought it was amazing. I'm a huge fan of talk radio. And I will confess, I'm, like, actually in my car usually at this time listening to, like, Rush Limbaugh. Not because, like, I enjoy it, but it's like, and I'm just thinking, like, lie. And I'm just thinking, you got me. No,
it's
and then
better
I'm thinking,
than coffee, that
and
adrenaline
then,
rush.
But I'm thinking, like, I'm thinking, what if somebody was doing something like that, but talking about, like, actual real issues? And to have this conversation that we're having today doesn't exist on any radio station that I listen to, and so to be able to be a part of that was one of the reasons why I said yes.
Absolutely, and thank you for saying that yes, because this has been a great contribution, and I really have loved your participation on Thursday morning.
Oh, so thank you so much.
Cool. And it's really great to hear the people you're bringing out. It's really great to hear this conversation going on, and please, good people, be a part of it. Support the Kickstarter campaign. Help us continue to build a city of media makers. That's what we do. We're KBOO, your community media station. We are on the internets. We are on the FM dial. We are where you need us to be. So continue keeping us there. Contribute. It's kboo.fm/Kickstarter.
And, you know, keep in mind, KBOO was never hired by the U.S. government to push the Iraq war like NPR was. Just something
absolutely
to think about.
True. Yeah.
Just something to think about.
I admit it.
You know, I can say that when we started bombing in 2003, oh my God, the word came out, and there were a few of us in the building at the time. We ran into the air room. There was a great music show on, and we looked at the DJ, and we were like, we just started bombing Iraq. You need to make way. We need to get people talking about this now. And he was like, oh, yeah, cool. Well, I had a really good show plan, but yeah, by all means, because we are spontaneous. We are responsive to community needs, and we understand emergency situations. So, you know, that's the kind of media we are. That's the kind of media you want in your life, and that's why you can support us at kboo.fm/Kickstarter.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that. Yeah, good to see you again.
It's so good to see you.
Oh, we got callers. There's a lot that I want to get to. Let's go ahead and take one, though. Jane, you're up. James, you are up. Ross, you are
up. This discussion you're having this morning, just to clarify, Trump is not a fascist. He is not smart. He has no. He's just anti-Obama, and Obama is basically just a capitalist. So he's just anti-Obama, which really gives.
Oh, we lost him. Oh no.
Oh. I can guess reply to that. I don't know what to say.
Ross, you can go ahead and call back. It's 503-231-8187. I want to get back to the conversation that we were talking about, anarchism. And, you know, I'm not a self-described anarchist. You probably know my politics better than I do. Am I an anarchist? No.
No, not yet.
I'm not like
your logo's getting there, though.
I'm not just like a liberal, though, right? Liberal?
You got a lot better than you were last year.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, cool. here's another thing. Everybody, you know, Malcolm X said a lot more eloquently than I'm about to, that everybody, you know, everything you know now, there was a time where you didn't know it, right? And so, like, that, you know, I was a little discouraged, not after the election, but before that, when I was seeing a lot of like the infighting and stuff, and it was like, your politics are trash, so you're trash. And I'm just like, well, you know, even the most like, well, for one, even you, there's somebody more radical than you, right? And
somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, and somewhere. And I haven't found him yet. But then there's somebody, you know, that's just a little less radical. There's some time where you were probably had different thoughts. Like, ooh, everybody's on their journey, right? And so, like, this idea that because you don't think like how I think now, that we throw you away instead of trying to, like, bring you along and have these conversations, I think leads to a lot of, like, the infighting that occurs. Mm-hmm.
Well, the most important part of anarchism to me is free association, associating with who you want to associate with. And that's really important because there's a lot of people, especially in this city, at protests and stuff that I do not want to talk to. Mm. I just don't want to talk to them. Not, you know, oh, Ross is back, but let me finish then real quick. Basically, what I'm trying to say is free association is great, but people have way too high of standards, and these standards are merely for social recognition rather than those actual personal standards being important. It's social capitalism, essentially. Uh-huh. People gaining popularity about being mad.
Yeah, but I mean, even the most popular person in Portland activist scene, like in the scheme of life, is not like famous.
Oh, yeah, like, no. So, like, no one's important here.
Maybe like Joey Gibson's probably like one of the most famous people in Portland activism, and that's a sad state of where we're at. Ross, you're back up.
Yo, hello.
Hello, we got you back.
Yo, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Well, I'm interested to know if you are organizing any demonstrations. Antifa demonstration?
I'm not. I don't organize. I'm merely just a ideologue, as people say, but there is on March 4th at Esther Park in Vancouver, Washington, there's a march against Trump and a march for Trump, and anti-fascists have made a call from Rose City Antifa for everyone to show up. So Vancouver, Esther Park, 12 p.m.
Well,
March 4th.
Yeah, well, I asked that because I've been involved, for example, in going to different demonstrations for a long time, like May Day demonstrations.
Oh, yeah.
And the May Day demonstration became quite a mass demonstration.
That's and a fun
I
part.
Have to say, it seems to me that you only show up at other people's demonstrations. And I wonder, do you have a position on what, how do you relate to the discipline of the demonstration that you come along with, so to speak?
Wait, can I speak to that?
If you participate in a May Day demonstration and they have a certain discipline of nonviolence and also a discipline against wearing masks and, you know, those kinds of things, how do you manage to keep it in harmony with that demonstration?
I think Greg wants to respond. Yeah, me and Greg have had this talk before.
Well, yeah, we have. And, you know, as somebody who does organize demonstrations, some of which where, you know, Black Bloc and Antifa shows up, I've been incredibly discouraged at the discussion that's happened afterwards where people, like, news come to me and are like, hey, how do you feel about your protest being co-opted? And I'm like, co-opted by who? The police? Because what happens more often, well, actually, the only thing that I've ever seen, and I can only speak towards Portland, I can't say for sure if this is what happens in other cities, where police start beating on people, pepper spraying, gassing people. Most of the people in the crowd are not incredibly radical or prepared to stand against the police. And people who would be identified by as Antifa by the media and stuff like that are there to defend and at least buy those people a little bit of time. But then that is not what gets shown to the media. I remember on May Day, I was right there where a fire gets started, and the headline is that, like, Antifa and Black Bloc is running around starting fires throughout Portland. But if you were there, what you saw is that police are marching on a peaceful crowd where there's, like, men, women, children, and dogs, and they had to be stopped somehow, or all of those people are going to be hurt. And I think that, you know, sometimes, you know, the responsibility, though, that then goes with that, because if one person in a mass throws something too early or prematurely, that does throw people in danger. And I think that we should be able to have that conversation of, hey, you shouldn't have done that because you're supposed to be here to protect people, and that might have put people in danger. But I think that we can't fall into these media traps of they show up and then co-opt and they're just there for a fight, especially when we're not talking about demonstrations, just the right versus the left, but when we're talking about just demonstrations of the left, I haven't seen that at all, and I've organized dozens of protests.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, you know, like that debate, I mean, that all depends on the predisposition of who owns the space. Whose event is it? Who owns any one event? May Day is not owned by anybody. I've been on the May Day Coalition organizing myself for 2 years before, and left for ideological differences, but I still go to May Day every year. Why? Because I'm a worker. May Day is celebrating the Haymarket Massacre, in which anarchists were killed by the police, and seven of them, the most famous being Louis Ling, were executed for bombing that they didn't even commit. And so there's history there as an anarchist for May Day. And specifically, May Day in Portland, what happened this year, talking about the fire, that fire distracted the police for 15 minutes, I counted. And then when the march moved up and was smashing stuff as it was moving up, the police were following. The police were not following the women and children and stuff who were trying to get out of there. Yes, that was a sticky situation that sucked for everyone involved. But the responsibility is not on the anarchists who were responding to police violence. The responsibility is on the police themselves who initiated that violence.
Well, let me ask what you think of my point of view, which is...
if you could keep it quick, because we're going to have to wrap up in a second.
Okay, the big picture is that every demonstration is a kind of a performance for a public and to achieve a certain end. Now, in the case of your approach is so good at capturing media that whatever the purpose and discussion could be about, the point is that you will get on the media. And the other side of the coin is that then Rush Limbaugh's and all the right wingers pick up that, and then they start organizing a bunch of fascists because they point at the left as being like you. So I'm wondering if you're not contributing to the right wing because you look so well, you look so dangerous and violent, and so they organize their violent movement and they use you as a prop.
So I've had this debate.
Thank you for the call. We're going to have to take the rest of
it. Okay.
But thank you for the
call.
Very
good. Thank you.
Anyways, to respond to that, so I've been an anarchist since before Occupy. This all happened during the Occupy, the same debate. And so it's a very easy thing to respond to in terms of, well, the other side's going to use that as ammunition for propaganda. I have seen more anarchists in this city now than I did 5 years ago. And that's after all the rioting. And that's evidence enough to me that rioting works. Me, I told this to Gregory before, and I think Gregory's come around to it, but Portland...
Don't put that...
I said maybe, but Portland was not on the map as a city that cared until after the riot in the Pearl District.
Yeah, okay, yes.
That riot put Portland on the map. Just going to put it that way.
I agree with that. We have more callers, but I want to get to a couple important things first, and we might not be able to get to both of them, but let's try and make this quick. Masks, make the case. Why?
Why? Because I like keeping my job and providing for my family.
Okay, and surviving, right?
Surviving, yeah. I need a mask to stay out of prison, to actually keep my job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't wear masks, though, personally anymore, because I don't do anything anymore.
So that's the other point people say. If you're not here to commit a crime, then why would you have to wear a mask?
Well, I mean, it's as simple as I don't want to be known to be there.
It's as easy
as that.
Okay, perfect. But because you're wearing a mask doesn't necessarily mean you're there to commit a crime.
No, it just means you don't want people to know who you are.
And if people are wearing a mask and there's let's say a peaceful protest or something like that, are they okay with like people not wearing a mask approaching them and just like having a conversation?
Yeah, totally. Okay, I actually invite people to do that. Talk to people wearing masks.
That's what I think should happen more often, because it's like those scary people, but like if those people were not wearing a mask, they're not scary people. And
right.
I think the part of why this show I think is going to end up being so powerful is because you are sort of just by talking and the way you articulate things break a lot of the stereotypes that people have.
Oh, yeah.
That they're just like the dumb kids that don't have jobs that just go out there to smashy smashy just because and they don't really have an ideology or care mm-hmm. about things. They don't read books. Like, mm-hmm. and that's not what this is.
Oh, right? Yeah. No, I mean, that idea comes from actually not reading books.
Yeah.
You know, simplifying the idea, you know, the ideas of rioting into simply this, you know, classification of teenage angst, when in reality, riots have always just been working class manifestations of anger.
And the last thing I want to make sure that we cover before we get to these last calls is, why do these people need to be shut down? So, you know, when we have these racist speakers come, let's say if Richard Spencer came or Milo came, I assume there would be like an Antifa response to that. I heard somebody say recently the best way to show that a racist is an idiot is to let them talk. And I'm not saying I agree with that, but I think that it's a point worth debating. Shouldn't we allow some people to talk and show that they're idiots, or why do we have to shut them all down?
It depends on what's being said, but a lot of people, you know, kind of have that scorched earth policy where, you know, you let a little bit squeak out and a lot of it's going to rush, and which is not wrong per se, but my approach is what is the person preaching right now? Are they just simple street preachers calling everyone different slurs because they want to?
Mm-hmm.
Like, sure, beat them up, I don't care. Or are they just some crazy right winger who doesn't really know what he's saying and is just kind of parroting talking points?
Yeah.
You know, where is the speech coming from? Who's saying it? And why are they saying it? That's kind of what depends for me if I'm going to shut down someone's speech.
If we, as the left or anybody, stopped responding to the Patriot Prayer Joey Gibson events, what would the harm be? And what would there be a benefit?
That's hard to say because
it's worth debating, right?
It's absolutely worth debating. Simply, my point of view is I do not think it's worth it to leave them alone. I think we need to change our engagement, but I don't think it's worth it to leave them alone. Leaving them alone, they do still have kind of a social rupture that they're taking advantage of in terms of the left and right divide. Mm. And if we let them completely dominate that narrative, then we're losing ground even more so than we already have.
Yeah.
But constantly engaging them in these street fights that we are losing, it's not a good idea.
We're losing those street fights?
Oh, I think so. I mean, did you see the video from Olympia?
No.
So
they all look the same to me at this point, so I just stopped watching them.
It's actually a really important video to watch. You can see Russell Schultz, heart attack Russell Schultz, hope he hears that, beating up a woman on the ground, punching her in the face.
Oh, I did see that.
They attacked only the women, femmes.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they, I don't know those people's pronouns, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, only the weaker presenting targets. And they absolutely beat them up, and that's a problem to me.
And they spun it as like positive for
them. Oh yeah, they were like, oh, look at us beating up the tough Antifas. Like,
yeah,
I didn't see any. What are you talking about? You bragging about that?
And then I forgot I had one more thing that I wanted to cover, and we could have probably did a whole show on this. Let's make some people mad. I think me and you disagree on this, not to where it's like a huge deal or anything, but guns.
I believe an armed, ready working class is the most powerful thing.
What about the NRA?
I actually I used to have a membership with the NRA because the benefits were nice.
But do you support the NRA?
Support the NRA? No.
And you know, I assume huge amounts of money in politics is not an anarchist position anyway.
Oh,
so yeah.
No.
So what about like the common sense gun control? I know we're talking about like minor policies and stuff, but we're not in like the big anarchist utopia type mm-hmm. talk. But when we talk about like the what people call common sense gun legislation, like banning bump stocks, which I concede I have no idea what that means, or like assault weapons bans or whatever. I'm not a gun guy, so I literally... I'm at a slight disadvantage in this argument because I have no idea what I'm talking about. I just know that I don't want to get shot.
Right, right. And, you know, no one does want to get shot. I've seen people get shot before, and it's not pretty.
No, that sucks.
But So the way I frame gun control debates is I'm going to keep my gun as long as my enemies have theirs. And my enemies include
the cops.
Police. Yeah, exactly. The cops, the state in general, the capitalist class.
Yeah.
And as long as they have weapons, I'm not going to concede mine.
But you can't defend, like, no matter what you have, you can't defend yourself from the cops, right?
I mean, you can. You're not going to live.
You're not going to live.
You can try.
Yeah. But like this idea of like armed revolution, like is that possible with the United States military?
I mean that, no, I do not think an armed revolution of just America going against like in a civil war, Russian, you know, revolution situation. There's no way with drones.
Yeah.
Who knows what they have in R&D development?
The NSA, like I mean, probably, oh God, like, yeah. I mean.
They know
it's not
what
a fair fight.
They know what porn you're gonna watch before you even go to.
They
pick
probably
a video.
Knew like they probably knew that you were here 3 minutes before me. Like
right, exactly. They probably predicted that I was gonna be on this radio show. So,
okay, so that was a lot to cover in just a few minutes. Let's take a call if we have time. You're gonna have to, Edie, you're gonna have to make it quick, Edie.
I'm talking about 6 Kickstarters to further the work that we need to do to make our world.
I don't know if we have time for 6.
Anarchism. Anarchism, KABU, Rose City Antifa, Portland's Resistance, and the No Bollywood Bridge Pipeline Kickstarter for the Week of Solidarity and Action, and then to answer those questions on how to talk with folks and move them from fascist behaviors. The White Ally Toolkit, you can look online and learn how you can take care of yourself and communicate with others to transition others. A Kickstarter towards a better world.
Thank you. That was a great timed call. So let's thank you for that information. We have another one, James.
Hey. So as far as guns go, I mean, there's no reason why we can't be armed. But the thing is that we have a bunch of people who don't. We just have a bunch of people who have guns, but they, like you said, they don't read books. They listen to people to oversimplify. And I think the reason why we haven't prevailed is because anytime we get a victory slump, and then we don't have anything pushing towards what we actually need to be doing. So in the meantime, as we can gain more ground against these Trumpites, I don't even call them fascists because they're not smart enough to be fascists, but as we can gain ground against these Trumpites, we need to keep pushing. We need to have voices that continually move us in the correct direction.
Awesome. I appreciate it. That was a great thought. I think that also when we talk about guns, a lot of people don't realize, and again, I'm sort of playing devil's advocate because I do believe in at least common sense gun legislation. I will say real quickly, my quick solution, I think, to gun problems is make it harder for the people that obviously shouldn't have guns to get guns. I don't think we should ever be like taking people's guns away because I think that's going to end badly. But the problem I see is how ingrained guns are into our culture and how they're viewed as a way to solve problems. And I think, and so I think that it's not necessarily the physical weapon itself that we need to only be talking about, but how do we sort of make them less prevalent within our culture? And I think that maybe a way to do that is make them harder to manufacture. And even if we're talking about guns being less prevalent in 100 years, it's worth working towards that to where people don't have to be scared to go to school. But a lot of people don't talk about the racist history of gun laws. I mean, we like the first ones that we're seeing of gun control and that term really popping off is when the Black Panthers were going to the state house in Sacramento or throughout the country. Black Panthers are walking around armed, and then people in power say, "Oh, we have to do something about these guns that are out in the streets." So, gun control has not been about these white mass shooters forever. For a long time, it has been about minorities having guns. And then we also look at cities like New York who have more of a ban, and it leads to things like stop and frisk, which is obviously racist policing and increased policing. So I think that something has to be done, but I think that it's somewhat of a privileged position to say let's just go ban guns, because they're not going to be going into Ted Wheeler's neighborhood and taking the guns from those people. What they're going to be doing is searching Black kids on the street or poor white people on the street for their guns.
And another point too with gun control laws, All gun control laws would do would limit the market too. That's why the NRA is so against it. It's not because the idea of controlling guns, it's limiting market space. You know, if we ban assault guns, for example, there goes half of Smith & Wesson's market share. There goes H&K, unless they're producing pistols again, which I can't remember. A lot of gun manufacturers are going to go out of business with that, and that's the NRA's interest, is protecting gun business. But on the point of manufacturing, with $20, I can go into Home Depot right now and make a gun in less than 10 minutes.
Really?
I can make a 9mm zip gun, yes. It is that easy.
Man.
Guns.
You're throwing away my... I was going to write a book
on
this. I
know. I'm sorry. But like, if you have a drill press, for example, too, and just a steel pipe, you can make a zip gun. All a zip gun is, you know, is it's just blasting the bullet out.
Sure.
That's it. And you can do it under $20.
And I think we're about out of time. Let's... do you have anything that you want to plug that's going on? A book you want people to read? Anything? Someone to follow? Something like that?
Actually, a book... Fascism, What It Is and How to Stop It by my friend Shane Burley. You can order it on Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble's. You can get it at Powell's. It is a really good book that I highly suggest everyone read if they're interested in anti-fascism.
Who do you vote for? Do you not vote?
I don't vote.
At all?
At all.
Except for weed.
Except for weed.
But what about like if we're talking about like healthcare or like things that really do affect people's life, you still don't vote?
If there was a bill for actual universal healthcare without a tax increase and without a tax penalty, I would vote in favor.
But is universal healthcare anarchism?
Yeah, universal healthcare is socialism.
But anarchist.
Anarchism and socialism
blowing
aren't necessarily...
my mind,
yo. They're not against each other. Anarchism is a position of authority. Socialism is a position of capital.
Interesting. All right. Well, that is it. That was a great show. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, callers.
Thank you, K-Boo. Thank you, callers. Stand up. Stand up.